Good afternoon, everybody. Like state call, state senate, state affairs. I'll get it right. Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, April 26, 2022. Let the record reflect times 3:33 p.m. We have President, myself, Chair Schauer. We've got Vice Chair Senator Reinbold, Senator Holland, Senator Kawasaki. Please silence your cell phones. Helping us today, we've got Naresh from my office. Carrie with Senate Records, Nate from the LIO. Three bills in today's schedule. We're going to start with Senate Bill 220, moving on to Senate Bill 119 and Senate Bill 195. But we're going to switch the order on that just so it said that. We're going to do 119 last so we can take our time there and get it out. So starting off today with Senate Bill 220, an act relating to a residency requirement for permanent full-time state employees in the classified, exempt, or partially exempt services relating to allowable absences for permanent fund dividend eligibility and providing for an effective date. This is the first hearing of the bill. We've got Senator Wilikowski, who's the bill sponsor, at the table when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bill Wilikowski, state senator representing East Anchorage and Jaybear, and with me is Sonia Kawasaki, chief of staff in my office. This bill requires state employees to reside in Alaska. Many people assume that state employees are required to live in Alaska, but that's not the case. And with the pandemic, the state began allowing more workers to work remotely. And unfortunately, we've found that a small but growing number of these employees are not coming back. And by way of example, we learned in the Senate Finance Committee about a month and a half ago that nearly 10% of the employees at the Permanent Fund Corporation have moved out of state within the last year. And they are required to fly back to Alaska for meetings at least quarterly. And when they do, the state pays for their travel, pays for their lodging, and actually pays their per diem. It just doesn't sit right with a lot of people. I think there's a lot of good public policy reasons to require that state employees live in Alaska. First and foremost, we have one of the highest unemployment rates in the nation, so we should be employing Alaskans rather than having people outside employed earning Alaskan dollars. The money is should be spent here in Alaska. Public dollars should be circulated in our economy. They help our small businesses. They help the overall economy. Believe it ensures efficiency here in the state and keeps talented Alaskans here. And there's a host of other issues that arise when you start allowing state employees to work outside. Issues like payroll taxes. The state could be required to pay outside payroll taxes, could be required to follow overtime laws, which differ in other states, required to follow other states' workers' compensation laws. The state could be required to follow paid sick leave laws, paid family leave laws, which could be better or could be worse than in Alaska. And I think there are just a host of problems that are created by allowing this, and I think this is a reasonable solution. And happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wilikowski. Before we go to the sectional, we'll just go ahead and open it up. I do have one right from the start. So obviously we have other industries that it's private, state, et cetera, where they might live and work in other states and do things. Is something you have explored the constitutionality of telling somebody that they can't live in a certain place and work in another, because this obviously happens all over the world? So do you anticipate problems with that, a constitutional challenge, legal challenges? And in addition, are you aware of any other states that are doing or requiring this, and have they been challenged, what the court precedent might be?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's a great question, and it's actually the exact question that I asked my staff before we came down here. And she directed me to a legal opinion that we received from our legislative legal department, where they said, and if I could read a quote, continuing residency requirements in order to maintain government employment have generally survived challenges alleging violations of various provisions of and rights guaranteed by the United States Constitution. So our legislative legal department has opined that they do not believe this would be subject to a constitutional challenge. We're happy to get you that opinion. And I would just bear in mind, this doesn't apply to just reiterate, this does not apply to private industries. This is only for state workers.
Anything that you have like that would be good if we get that uploaded in the public record as well, and get it for committee members. Are there other questions? Senator Ramble?
I am inclined to not support all these telemedicine, telehealth, teleprescribed, tele-everything, because God only knows who's on the other side of the line, and I think healthcare is something that is best when you're in the presence, because you see a lot more with the patient and assess things, and it's like Zoom. I just fundamentally I'm not a big fan of. I just think there's so much more value to meeting one-on-one, especially with a group. So my question in regards to this is, what do you think this – do you think that is a good basically analysis of why you think that employees, full-time state employees, should be present?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Reinbold. That's certainly a concern that I share as well. I think there may be situations where people should work or can't have that option available. I don't think it should be the standard option. I think it should be sort of the rare exception where that happens. And this bill deals with out of state. This doesn't deal with telework, but it's basically saying if you're out of state, then obviously you can't come to work. And so that's the situation we're trying to address. But I think Alaskans are better served by having their state employees in Alaska working in an office or out in the field. I think Alaskans are just better served that way.
Follow up.
Okay, so thank you, because I mean, to me, this does relate very, very much to telemedicine, because we don't want to undercut the workers here in the state of Alaska. I think it's a really important issue. And I will tell you that we just addressed this in legislative budget and audit, and we put extremely tight parameters, like up to one or up to two people, maybe auditors, because they had a really well-established long-term relationship with the state of Alaska. They were auditors for family reasons or something. They needed to move out. So we either allowed one or two, I can't remember, up to two to live out of state. But anyway, if there were amendments to this bill, I think that there needs to be, if there's an exception, it needs to be a very justified exception.
They have a comment, more of a question?
I don't disagree.
Okay. Other questions, comments? Senator Holland?
Thank you, Senator Wilkoski, for bringing this up. I was unaware of it, but and I would be concerned when you talk about the employees. Are they receiving per diem to travel back to Alaska for work, and then covering the airfare back? That would be really interesting if that was happening. I can understand this almost in the world of telehealth, telecommuting, tele-everything, with the idea of if it's cost-saving. But it just kind of strikes me as improper. So truly, people are receiving per diem to travel back to Alaska for a required visit to their home office or something like that.
Senator Holland, through the chair, that's what we were told in Senate Finance regarding the employees who are working for the Permanent Fund Corporation. I don't know what other departments do. But I was shocked to hear that as well, that we're paying for their travel and we're paying for their per diem and we're paying for their lodging when they are choosing to live outside and take the money that we pay them outside, and then we're paying them to come back to Alaska. That was shocking to me.
All right.
Go ahead.
And I don't want to be targeting the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. I'm sure they do great work. But I'd be curious, beyond, do we know anything about beyond that particular portion? If this is also something with just state employees across the state?
Yeah, thank you, Senator, through the chair. We asked the Legislative Research Division to look into this exact issue and find out how widespread this was. And Legislative Research Division notified us that they attempted to contact the state personnel director multiple times for information on the number of state employees who currently reside out of the state and presumably work full-time for the state. And unfortunately, we were informed by legislative research that they received no response, which the failure to respond concerns me. And I'd be happy to get something in writing from the Legislative Research Division saying that they made these inquiries, but that concerns me. Why wouldn't they respond? We did reach out to a number of state corporations. Legislative Research reached out to Alaska Gas Line Development Authority, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, Alaska Industrial Development and Export Corporation, Alaska Energy Authority, and Alaska Mental Health Trust. Each reported zero employees working from out of state. So that's a positive thing. But from the executive branch, we don't have an answer back on that.
One last question. Go ahead. And thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one last question. So you talked about using the PFD, qualifying for the PFD, but that is not the only standard. You can use other methods to qualify, correct?
Yes, Senator, through the chair. I think there could probably be an infinite number of ways you could say it. You could set a time limit that a person needs to be here. We just thought tying it to something which just about every Alaskan gets, the dividend, is an easy way to verify it. If someone left the state, it can be challenging to verify, but just looking and seeing whether you got a dividend is a pretty easy way to do that.
One quick follow-up?
I'm not going to say it. Go ahead, Senator Holland.
I was actually an employee a resident of Alaska and a employee of the state of Alaska for 9/10 of the year in question. And on a technicality, I did not qualify for the permanent fund dividend for my first full year that I had a chance to. And I would hate to think that someone's employment was at risk because of a technicality. That's my only concern about it can be challenging to qualify for the PFD. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Quick follow-up. Got it. So, Senator Wilkowski, I would be interested to get that answer from probably Department of Administration as well. So if you would send that request in writing that you had, I'd like to forward that. As we'll do that as a committee request to see if we can put a little more horsepower behind getting an answer. I would be curious as why they didn't answer it, if there may be a reason, but they can tell us what that is. But I'd like to know the data across the board, because that is, like I said, that is a trend that's happening today anyways. So there's definitely things we'd like to know. So if you guys could do that, we'll try to get it as well.
Absolutely.
Other questions at this point? Then we'll go to the sectional.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members of the Senate State Affairs Committee. I'm Sonia Kawasaki, staff to Senator Wilkowski. Senate Bill 220, sectional analysis. Section 1, state employees, state residency is required, determination, termination, and regulation authority. Section 1 creates three new sections in law. Section 3925025 establishes requirements that a full-time employee of the state in a classified, exempt, or partially exempt position must be or become a resident of the state for continued state employment. Section 3925027 provides that the state director of personnel must annually determine whether state employees who are subject to the residency requirement and who have been employed for the entire previous calendar year are not eligible for a permanent fund dividend in the current year, which links the employee's eligibility for continued state service to the employee's right to receive a PFD. An employee who would qualify for a PFD but who is ineligible because the employee did not actually apply for a PFD, or an employee who does not qualify due to certain criminal convictions that do not prevent the state employment but disqualifies the employee for a PFD, may still be eligible for continued employment. The director must notify affected departments of an employee who is not eligible for a PFD and who is not otherwise accepted from the requirement, and the employee shall be terminated. Section 3925029 authorizes the Commissioner of Administration to adopt regulations to implement these provisions. Section 2, clarifying language added for employees who must work out of state. Current law provides limitations on the duration that a PFD applicant may be absent from the state and still be eligible for a PFD. An exception exists for state employees who work in, quote, a field office or other location, end quote. The bill adds clarifying language that the employee's presence in the location that is out of state must be necessary to fill the employee's job duties. Section 3, applicability to collective bargaining agreements. The new residency requirement does not apply to collective bargaining agreements entered into before the bill's effective date. Section 4, transition provision for applicability to current state employees. A current state employee may continue state employment until January 1, 2024, despite ineligibility for state service under the new residency requirement. Section 5, effective date. The act is effective July 2, 2022.
Okay. Thank you, Sonia. Questions for the sectional analysis from committee members? Senator Holland?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A different question, not necessarily sectional analysis, just another quick question. Are there State of Alaska employees that are required to live outside? What comes to mind is the Alaska Gas Line Corporation and at least one or two positions in Texas.
Through the chair, Senator Holland, the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation stated in an email to our Legislative Research Division that their employees are not actually considered employees of the state, but also actually reported that zero of their employees live outside the state, work outside the state.
Okay, follow up.
I that still doesn't answer the question as far as like, are there Alaska employees required? I just threw the AGDC as a example, but are there State of Alaska employees required to live outside the state?
Well, Senator, through the chair, I can't think, well, the only ones I can think of off the top of my head would be our congressional delegation, for which there's an exception in the PFD statute. And we have, the governor has someone that they hire to work in D.C. That person, congressional staff, would be required to live outside. And I'm not aware of others that would be, but we can certainly look into that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just be worried about carve-outs to protect their positions, their employment.
Through the chairs. Senator Holland, the carve-outs are already existing in the PFD absence, permissible absence statutes, and so all of our bill would link to the PFD permissible absences. So to the extent there are carve-outs for state employees, our bill clarifies that the employment outside in another locale has to be necessary for the performance of the job duties.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep. Thanks. I was going to ask about ASME, but my former ASME staff member that was ASME said that we used to have 8 PCNs in Seattle, but they've all been moved back. So I guess it answers that question. But that's a good question to ask. So, yeah, if there isn't any, we find out DOA might be able to help us with that. I guess we get a response. Senator Rambel?
Thank you. I'm going to go down the rabbit hole because I think it was a good one with Senator Holland. AGDC, they used to have a very, very expensive, by far, when I did all the who was most expensive and judicial and then the executive branch, judicial branch, and legislative branch, he was by far, I mean, and he was from out of state. So I'm intrigued that he's not out of state apparently now, whoever that person is going to be. But I think that is something that I'd definitely like to validate that information, because I tried to eliminate that job position when I was doing budget cuts. Just eliminated it because it was like worth 10 or 20 other positions basically. So that's the one of my points. Another point was when Senator Sullivan, U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan, was telling us how many of the federal employees that supposedly worked on behalf of the state resided in Washington State. That's why I'm actually intrigued by this bill. So I don't know. Those are more points. Maybe you guys can turn it into a question, but it just definitely, because of his comments, I think that you may be onto something important here. So.
Thanks. Senator?
Yeah, we, like I said, we had requested this information from legislative research, and I disclosed that what the response we got. I just to respond directly on AGDC, we have a letter from Frank Richards, the president of the Alaska Gas Line Development, who responded in a one-line response to Chuck Burnham from legislative research, quote, "We are not State of Alaska employees, period. All our employees work in Alaska, period." Okay. That's what we got.
Good. I would also be interested if we're going to ask DOA, it may have the Department of Law on that. Since we're talking the executive branch, I'd be curious to see if they have a differing opinion. If they do, why that is. We'll see what they say. Okay. Other questions from committee members at this time? We had not noticed public testimony. So I'll give you the floor, Senator Wilkowski, if you have any final comments for now.
I don't. Thank you.
Thanks. Appreciate you guys coming to get this bill. Something I hadn't thought about till now. So it's kind of interesting topic. If anybody has amendments, they'll be due to the office by close of business this Friday, April 29th. And for now, we're going to go ahead and set the bill aside, bring it back at a future date. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to move on to Senate Bill 195 due to a time issue with another committee. This is an act relating to the compensation of certain public officials, officers, and employees not covered by collective bargaining agreements and providing for an effective date by Senator Keel, who has made his way to the table. Senator Keel, when you're ready, we'll go ahead and open it up if you want to kind of give us back to the highlight of it and where we are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, I am Jesse Keel. I have the privilege of representing Senate District Q here in northern southeast Alaska. I'm joined by Kathy Schlinghide of my staff. Thank you for having a third hearing on this bill. Just as a reminder to the committee, this is a catch-up bill for state workers who are not covered by a union. It provides a 5% total pay increase spread out over 2 years, two and a half. And that catches up with the last round of general government employee pay increases. These employees covered by the bill have not had an adjustment to the salary schedule take effect since 2015. We are past due to catch them up with the union employees who, incidentally, almost all have finished their negotiations and have a new round of increases going into effect. This bill doesn't touch those. This catches up with the last one. Mr. Chairman, I'd also need to correct one misstatement that I made on the record in a previous hearing. I said this bill affects every single employee at the Department of Law. That is not correct. The non-attorneys at Department of Law are largely covered by a union, but all of the attorneys at the Department of Law would be caught by this bill.
Thank you. Questions, comments from committee members? Senator Ramble.
Okay. I remember a bill very similar to this back in 2014, and it was an average of $10 million a year. It was the cost, and it continued to go up. Representative Munoz at the time carried the bill, and she said it was basically for her 5,000 constituents, you know, to get raises, you know, in her district. Where my concern is right now is the private sector has been almost annihilated to a certain degree, especially a lot of the small businesses due to COVID. And this may not settle well with the private sector, that people, union people and public employee people and sometimes legislators don't seem to hear their voice because they're independent, small, but yet the public employees, everybody seems to, you know, listen to and take their heed, what they need, their little raises, as businesses were wiped out. And so to me, I'm kind of, you know, mixed. I understand, oh, you want to make the same as the unions, but, you know, sometimes the private sector that's paying all these bills needs some empathy, needs some sympathy, needs some encouragement. So, you know, I want to know the fiscal note, is bottom line in regards to this, and what's the projected expenses in the future?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In answer to Senator Reinbold, there are just over 2,800 exempt and partially exempt employees statewide, so I can assure you that there are not 5,000 in Juneau. The total fiscal note comes to approximately, the first 2.5% comes to a cost of approximately $8.6 million total. Of that, some is federal, some is program receipts, but the unrestricted general fund is 5.75. It's $5.78 million. And then in the second year, a very similar number. I think it's 8.8 total. So those costs are, again, reflective of these very modest 2.5%, followed the next year by another 2.5% increases for workers who have not seen an adjustment in their pay go into effect since 2015. Mr. Chairman, pleased to see wages rising in the private sector. That is, I think, past due in our country. That's not something we control as legislators. I am also pleased to see our economy beginning to bounce back. Certainly, we all have a lot of constituents in the small business world who have suffered, who have struggled under the pandemic, who have struggled from the loss of a tourism economy, who struggled with the economic results of low oil prices for many years. And I agree with Senator Reinbold, Mr. Chairman, they deserve a great deal of empathy. I think it is noteworthy that even as they struggle, many, many, many of them are raising wages for their employees by significantly more than 2.5%. And so this bill, I'll say again, is just a small catch-up for several past years. It is certainly not on par with the wage growth that we are seeing on average, and certainly not everyone, but on average in the private sector.
Does that have a follow-up?
Yes. So basically for state employment, it's 37.5 hours and very lucrative time off and benefits, et cetera. For the private sector business, often it's 40, 50, 60, 70 hours a week. They have far more responsibilities, payroll, all that. They have to take on all the responsibility. The owners, you know, have relentless hours often. So I understand what you're saying to a degree, but in the bottom line is, I believe it was Senator Bishop, I wish I could remember exactly who recently told me this, but there was something like 75,000 job losses over the last 2 years with COVID. A vast majority of them, I don't know of a single bureaucratic job that got cut, but thousands of jobs in the private sector. I just don't know how this is going to sit very well with all these people who have wiped out what they have built their whole life, and there's nobody seeming to have compassion or empathy on them or looking out for them. And I'm just not sure how this is going to set, you know, union raises and raises, not that they deserve them or not. I'm not going to go there, but just with the situation, especially for people that are cutting their permanent fund dividend. So all this permanent fund dividend money that helps the small sector business and kids get along, move on, but yet just simply look out. Just look out for big government. I just don't know how this is going to settle out there in the real world, in the public, in the private sector, that are having unprecedented pain. And a lot of them actually are leaving the state because they've just become disgusted with the fact that people just are not looking out for the private sector. I know that there might be a few anomalies that may be giving some raises out there. But the bottom line is that's the reason this bill I'm not saying yes, no, or indifferent at this point in time, but I'm just saying there's so many thousands of Alaskans and businesses that have just been wiped out. It's hard to go back to Anchorage sometimes just to see all the businesses that have been shut down. And so I'm just not sure that this is the good timing, to be honest with you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't disagree in any way that the private sector has struggled, and many folks are struggling. I will point out to one of the points Senator Reinbold made, that these are our exempt and partially exempt employees. They are not represented by unions. The vast majority of them are not overtime eligible. And many, many, many of them work significantly more than 37 and a half hour union contract state work week. That additional work is not compensated. Mr. Chairman, I'm not trying to draw an equivalence here. I'm talking about, and this bill works on how we as the Board of Directors for the state of Alaska address an inequity in the pay within our own employees, or rather our employees as well as those of the executive and judicial branches.
Point of clarification.
Go ahead, Senator Rammel.
So just point of clarification, I understand what this bill does. It's just like the other one. My point is it was the cause effect. Because the unions got the raise, now the non-unions. So that was my point, is all of them end up getting raises as businesses were wiped out across this state. And I think it was completely avoidable, to be honest with you. I think a lot of it lands in the executive branch mismanagement of COVID. But the bottom line is that it was a cause and effect. So with that, and I do agree that a lot of the union or non-union workers do work more than 37.5 hours. I've heard their pleas. So I do understand that. That was not my point at all. My point was the fact that all the private sector businesses don't have people looking out for them, and there are unprecedented suffering going on in this state. And at some point in time, I think we need to address that, because small businesses, the hard, you know, just remember the private sector pays the bills for big government, and just ignoring them and their needs is not wise. It's just not.
Senator, you want to respond?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Reinbold is not wrong about the suffering in Alaska's private sector. There's no argument here. And certainly we all work together on efforts to reopen our tourism industry. I have appreciated all the members here's support on resolutions to help try and get some of those customers flowing again. Right. I think it's fair to say that every member in this room is focused on economic recovery, and we'll work together on measures to help support economic recovery. So there's no disagreement with that.
Question? Go ahead, Senator Hall.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We hear the talk of encouraging non-union employment. There's, you know, to worry about the grip that unions may have, and I hate to think of people suffering because they may not be part of a union in this case. For the fiscal note, and I just I'm not a finance guy, so is this typically the way it's reported? Because I look in fiscal year 2023, it's got the $8.6 million, and I mean, if we're buying a building, to be that one expense of $8.6 million, but then in fiscal year 2024, there's $8.8 million. We're also going to pay that $8.6 million again. We've given the first 2.5% increase, so we are going to have the total 5% increase in 2024. That's just reflecting the other 2.5%. And then every year after that, it's like we're buying that $8.6 million, now $16 million building every year. Is it because, I mean, once it becomes salary, we don't count it against the budget again? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, in response to Senator Holland, there are a couple of ways these fiscal notes are sometimes represented. In this case, Senator Holland is correct, Mr. Chairman. The first 8.6 goes to the base budget. And so you see then the second year increment is an additional 8.8. So your analysis is correct. Mr. Chairman, Senator Holland's analysis is correct that the total cost of 5% is approximately, I'm doing the math on the fly, $17 million once fully implemented.
Very good. Thank you. Other comments, questions from committee members this time? Okay. And... all right, back on my script here. So what we're going to do here, Senator Keel, is I'm going to set this one aside today, and we'll discuss it a little bit further and make sure all the committee members' questions are answered. We're down one today, unfortunately, in the committee, so hopefully we'll have a chance. Maybe we can move this back next week and make sure all the questions are answered. So I appreciate you coming today, and we will discuss with your office as soon as we're done on maybe trying to bring the bill back before the committee.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, certainly I'm more than happy to take any questions from committee members or from your office before the bill gets back or here at the table as soon as you're ready.
You bet. Thank you very much for coming in. We've got it.
Brief at ease.
Brief it is. Senate State here is Senate State Affairs back on the record. A little bit of housekeeping there. Now we are going to go a little bit out of order for what we had put out. We are on to Senate Bill 119. Senator Rambler, I assume you're going to go to the table. Is that correct? Okay. And are you by yourself or is there staff? You got it? Okay. You got it. All right. We are moving on to Senate Bill 119, an act relating to oaths of office and requiring public officers to read the State Constitution, Declaration of Independence of the United States Constitution by Senator Rheinbold. We've heard this bill on April 12, 2022. We do have some amendments from the sponsor, which we're going to take up today, and we're also going to get to public testimony, and we'll see how it goes from there. I was hoping to move the bill out, but we'll take a look. Senator Rambles at the table when you're ready. If you want to do two things, put yourself back in the record, if you could top level again for people since we haven't heard it for a couple weeks, and then we'll get into the amendment process. So when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Rheinbold, District G. And basically what this bill does at a high level, SB 119, it's the oath of office. It just ensures, at the current version right now, it just ensures that any elected official, whether it's a judge, any of us, any commissioners, any public safety officer, before they take the oath of office, they have to read the Constitution and the State of Alaska Constitution. So that basically what we saw before is the judicial branch was doing it different than the legislative branch that was doing it different than the state troopers and all this. This just kind of uniform. It's a uniform thing where they all have to read it and then sign that they've read the Constitution prior to taking the oath of office.
Okay, thank you. And I'm going to open it up again to committee members to see if there's any questions before we move on at this time. Senator Holland?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have any comments or questions. Well, I don't have any questions. But I'll just say I did have a chance to see this, I think, in Senate Education.
You did.
Senate Judiciary. Yes. But and I have a few more questions as we go into amendments.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's correct. I saw it with you as well in Judiciary previously. So at this time, we do have a couple of amendments that are both from Senator Ramble's office. So, Senator Ramble, would you like to I'm just going to label them number one and number two. They didn't come that way. Number one is W.1. Number two is W.2. And do you want to go ahead and offer amendments at this time?
Sure, Mr. Chairman.
So when you're ready.
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number one, which is W.1.
And I will object for purposes of discussion.
Okay, so basically what W.1 is, it goes back to the original intent of the legislation, and it adds the Declaration of Independence. And the reason why that I really think the Declaration of Independence is that's our charter. The Declaration of Independence is our charter. And then the bylaws would be the Constitution. And many people that are far smarter than I say that they're inseparable, and it's just super, super important. So we have the charter and the bylaws, and they're like a wings of the eagle that fly, and you need both wings. You got to know your charter, and then the bylaws are set up in the Constitution. So that's a pretty simple explanation of a very important concept. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And just for the record, I'll put it out there because I was checking these before and the fiscal notes and how it went, and as I remember seeing this one on previous versions, because I think it's ended up with like four committees of referral when it started, or five, which is a lot for any bill. There was a zero fiscal note attached with this particular amendment. There was nothing that's added, so I just want that on the record. So I think Senator Holman, you said you had questions at this time?
Yeah. So even thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Reinbold. Even in your opening comments, you didn't mention the Declaration of Independence. You did mention the Alaskan U.S. Constitution. And I had concerns when I first saw this in Senate Judiciary, I still believe that as important as the Declaration of Independence is, it's not a requirement that that a state employee, you know, takes an oath to the Declaration of Independence like they do to the Alaska and the U.S. Constitution. I just want to make sure I am correct on that. Correct?
Through the chair, we take an oath to the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Alaska. That's correct. The reason why I didn't mention it in the first, because the version was changed and I wanted to speak to the version at hand. And that's the only reason why I left that out.
Okay, good on that. And a brief at ease. That state affairs is back on the record, I think, if we were ever off. All right, we'll see what comes up here in a minute. So we'll go back to questions, and I just want to get that out there because that popped up as a text. So were there other questions for Senator Reinbold on amendment number one? Senator Holland?
I'll just state that I'll probably – I won't be in support of this amendment because I've already voted to remove it from – but I do appreciate amendment number two that we're looking at right after this.
Okay. Senator Ramble, do you want any other comments? There's no other questions at this time.
I think it's so important. We're still only taking an oath to the Constitution. That's not changing at all. Okay. We're not changing the Constitution here. We're just making sure that people read the charter. And when I read the Declaration of Independence, it just reminds me of the pretty unbelievable conditions of when King George III, what he was doing to the colony, you know, to Americans. And so to me, it reminds me of why the rights that are outlined in the Constitution are so valuable. And I think that it enhances, you know, one enhances the other. But to clarify, we're taking an oath to the Constitution and to the...
Senator Holland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I tried to come up with an analogy in my mind of King George being an unresponsive dictator who's put taxation without representation. I was trying to figure out how to make an analogy to requiring people to read something that they are not required to read, no matter how good of an idea we think it is. It's not required by law for them to do it. And I have a hard time supporting this amendment for that reason.
Okay. Well, this time I'm going to go ahead and I've read all this stuff, so it doesn't bother me a bit, but that's okay. Just not because anybody told me to. I just wanted to. That being said, I'm going to go ahead and remove my objection. I assume, Senator Holland, you object?
I'll object.
Okay. And, Carrie, I do have one question. This doesn't happen too often. With Senator Reinbold sitting there, she's allowed to vote on amendments, correct? Okay. Yes, right? Okay, just making sure. It's a little weird, not used to having a committee member there. That being said, Carrie, can you call the roll?
Senator Reinbold.
Yes.
Senator Holland.
No.
Yes.
Yes. All right, with 3 yeas, 1 nay, amendment number 1 passes. Senator Reinbold, would you like to move your amendment number 2?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number 2, which is W.2.
I will object for purposes of discussion.
So do you want me to go? Sorry.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, sorry. I'm trying to follow protocol. Okay. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. What amendment number 2 does is it says that when they read the Constitution and take an oath and sign that they've read, basically I didn't want it to just go somewhere random. And that's why this originally was a part of a discussion like over a year ago. But the bottom line is it just shows that in the school board people, they would be, you know, filed with the applicable school board, you know, the oath and then where it would be the deed in SLAMS, that's the state libraries, archives, and museums would be, you know, where ours would be filed. And then with the different other areas, basically anybody else who takes their oath, it's all going to be kept in the state libraries, archives, and museums. I just think it would be really cool to be able to go back and look up, you know, that someone signed their oath of office, and it pretty much puts them the local in the local areas, but everybody else, you know, in one area for posterity, and also for just to remind people that it is on file, that they did take an oath, that they not only read it, but then they did take an oath to the Constitution. So with that, that's why just wanted to make sure that it went somewhere where people could have access to it, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Very good. Questions from committee members? Senator Holland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I also believe when we first heard this in State Affairs, after I saw it in Education, after I saw it in Judiciary, I could not believe that. Because I asked you about this, about where was it documented at? And I thought that was kind of like a missing piece to the puzzle to know where to go look for it. But I will be supporting this amendment. Thank you so much.
Mr. Chairman, can I respond?
Of course.
Go ahead, Senator. Thank you. Yes, I had to go back and read the journal and try to remember exactly what happened back then. And you're absolutely right. You did bring this issue up. It was something that I thought was important to know where to go. Where's it going to go in someone's office? You know, I do think that having it in a place like that, and I may be not remembering everything, but I thought that they said all you're doing is filing, so there wouldn't be a fiscal note if it went to SLAMS. You know, that's what I was trying to go back right before committee and find out, because they're really not doing much. They're just filing, and we have full-time staff over there, and sometimes it doesn't look very busy over there. So filing paper could even be done by a volunteer. So I believe that it would not add a fiscal note.
I was going to ask you, and thanks for answering that, because I brought that up just to make sure, because there was a finance referral, then it was removed, and just making sure we know what the status was. So. Okay, Senator Holland, thanks for asking that follow-up. Good. Senator Kawasaki?
Yeah. Do you know, Senator Reinbold, where the lieutenant governor files those oaths that we sign prior to, like right after we get sworn in, we sign those oaths? Do you know where those go?
I don't.
Okay. I have another question.
Go ahead, follow up, Senator.
So we're now requesting, according to the first part, amendment page 1, line 7, that the school board, that something be filed with the school board. Have you talked to any school boards or school districts and whether that's something that they can easily do, I guess? It's not a fiscal note because it's not a state entity.
Through the chair, we just thought it was most appropriate for local, you know, the local school boards to have it with their applicable. We wanted to put it with a municipality potentially, but this is something that can be worked out through regulation. So have we talked to each individual one? No, we have not. But in general, I have not had any opposition to the bill at all. And so just you don't want to put exactly, you know, every single detail of every single bill. You want to leave a little bit of flexibility in cases like this where they can, you know, they can kind of work it out. But I think it would be, for example, it could be a municipal clerk, or it could be, you know, the town hall center. I know we have one in Eagle River, but it is something that is not clearly specified. But it just says in general with the applicable school board.
And then through the chair, so would an REAA that doesn't necessarily have a school board, would the division or the Department of Education need to file those?
Through the chair, that would be a very good thought. I would say yes.
And then I guess just finally getting back to the potential of the fiscal note, has anyone been contacted by the State Library, Archives, and Museums to find out if there would be some sort of a fiscal note applied to this, if they need to store it, save it, categorize it like they normally do?
And through the chair, I was trying really hard to go back and read through all the journals. I thought we had them on way back when, you know, when this bill, it has a lot of obstacles for something so simple. I'm actually shocked. But my personal opinion is I can't imagine them needing a full-time person or even a part-time person to file, you know, oaths of office. They file stuff all, you know, and they put books away, they file, you know, certain things. It just seems to me like filing the pretty small number of overall people that take an oath of an office, filing should not. I could not remember. That's what I would try to say at the beginning. My recollection is that there would not be an additional fiscal note for just filing something that we sign. So, but I can't answer the question absolutely with certainty.
Senator Kawasaki, I will add, I went back and looked at it too, just to try to track it. And this was originally given a fiscal note and then it was removed later. So I'm a little fuzzy as to why that happened early on, because I think they gave it right from the beginning. Senator Reinbold, you had a funny look in your face like that. It's different. But when I looked at it earlier today before when I asked you the question, it was given finance and then it was removed at some point. So I thought that was rather interesting. I think it's because it was removed, or maybe they came back and said that it wasn't. So I'm not sure how that happened.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to try to be as professional as I can right now. But this bill got an unbelievable number of referrals. And my recollection is it got the referral, but the fiscal note wasn't attached at all. And that's why the fiscal note got removed. It was just an interest in giving this bill a heavy lift. But I never remember seeing a fiscal note. There was actually a cost.
Yeah, and that's my point, Senator Ramos. Yeah. I think there was a fiscal. I think it was referred to finance before we even heard it, and then later the finance referral was moved almost as if it was put on as a referral, and then removed later when they realized there wasn't going to be one or something to that effect. I don't know the whole story. I'm just providing a little more context to Senator Kawasaki's question about why it was there and was removed, because I couldn't find any fiscal notes later. They were all zero, and there was five of them attached on basis, so just for what it's worth. I think that may be why it got removed later. So, yeah, there's five of them that are zeros there. Yep, thank you. Okay, other questions, comments at this time? Okay, so that being said, I'm going to go ahead and remove my objection to amendment number 2. Are there any further objections? Okay, seeing and hearing none, amendment number 2 will pass. All right, at this time, we're going to go ahead and open up public testimony. Well, Senator Ramble, do you have any other comments at this point for that? Okay, and we're going to go ahead and open up public testimony on Senate Bill 119. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? Seeing and hearing none, we do have, I see one online, Philip Moser. Philip, if you can hear me, if you'd put yourself on the record, name, who you represent, location, and if you could keep it 2 minutes or less, I'd appreciate it. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. My name is Philip Moser. I'm testifying on behalf of myself from Juneau, Alaska. I think for the first time, I'm testifying in support of a bill put forward by this particular legislator. I'd like to declare my support, especially because it requires officials to read the Declaration of Independence. Particularly, this helps bring up some of the hard issues that are related part and parcel with the creation of the United States and its relations with slavery and with the extermination of Native American people. In the Declaration of Independence, there's a couple of grievances that are lifted to the King of England. And while it says that all men are created equal, the last of the 27 grievances against King Henry George III read like this. He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. Around that time, the settlers were breaching out into already inhabited lands and stealing those. Specifically, they were even doing that when the king had treaties with Native American groups to protect and preserve those land-owning rights. Secondly, the Declaration of Independence brings light to the issues that the founding of America had with slavery. A large part of that was how King George III helped create incentives for enslaved people to rise up against their owners, which I'm certainly not against. Both of these things were integral to the creation of the United States and the Declaration of Independence, and I fully support Ms. Reinbold's efforts to make sure that everyone that serves the public office knows about these things. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for calling in today, Philip, and taking the time to testify. All right, I see nobody else online. Stair check. We're going to go ahead and close public testimony. I sent up a 119. Do committee members have any further questions or comments for the sponsor this time? All right. And Senator Ramble, one last chance. You have the floor if you have anything else you want to say.
Just thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want people to – I think some people can get lazy, I guess, and not go back and remember the hardships of what we did to – what the Founding Fathers did to fight off tyranny. It was very serious. And that's why I think making sure that we not only read the Declaration so and also what we take an oath to, which is critical, so we understand our jobs. And the Constitution helps confine government, and I think sometimes we really can get way outside of the parameters because we lose focus of the supreme law of the land, and that is the U.S. Constitution. So just reminding us to read it, and I try to read it on September 17th, Constitution Day, just to remember how valuable that document is. It's of critical importance to our freedom, and I think the last 2 years we've experienced a violation of those more than ever before. And so with that, it's an honor, a true honor, to have the opportunity to present this before Senate State Affairs today. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Reinbold. Like I said, I do agree with the foundation. I've read it myself, all of them, multiple times. All right, seeing no further action on the bill, Senator Holland, do you have a motion for the will of the committee? Brief at ease. Senate State Affairs back in the record. Go ahead, Senator Holland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate Bill 119, version 32-Lima Sierra 0163/Whiskey, attached fiscal notes, individual recommendations, and accompanying documents be moved out of the Senate State Affairs and onto the next committee of referral as amended.
Thank you, Mr. See, I'm doing it now. Starts a trend. Senator Holland, does anyone object to moving the bill out of committee? Seeing or hearing none, Senate Bill 119 passed from committee. We're going to go ahead and sign the paperwork after just to keep things moving. End of the script. Who needs these things anymore? All right, that concludes our business for today. The next meeting is going to be this Thursday, April 28, 2022 at 3:30 p.m. back here. Seeing no other business for the committee, we're going to adjourn out at 4:27 p.m. Thanks, everybody.